Magda, to say that this is the highlight of my week is an understatement. We've got so much to discuss, and I want to drill down into your investment themes. But before we go there, we are halfway into 2024. I can't believe it's mid-July. And I thought it would be great to get a sense of what the last 6 months has entailed for you, just to get a sense of your context at the moment.
Thanks, Broadway. Very kind of you. So I currently split my time between South Africa and UK. In South Africa, I run Signia and very excited about it, new positioning and a new strategy. And in the UK, just pre-pandemic, I set up a venture capital fund. And I think that is one of the best things that I could have done at this stage of my career, because it has given me a much more global perspective on events that are happening than just sitting in South Africa and trying to interpret the various political issues that are clearly impacting on the market. And some of the very interesting forums that I've become exposed to has been, for instance, every quarter I go to United States. I'm invited to this Yale Business Forum where some of the biggest companies and their CEOs are invited, as well as some politicians. And there is a whole lot of exchange between what business can expect from regulation. So that's an amazing forum for learning what very US-centric, but what US is doing, how business is viewing US, its economy, and effectively the events that are unfolding there. Of course, in September, there will be a lot of discussion around Trump versus Biden. Another interesting forum I've become involved in or invited to speak at is the Saudi Arabia's Davos in the Desert. And I spoke there last year, September, October. I'm doing it this year as well. And all of a sudden, you really get exposed, again, global thinking, global leaders, but as well to exposure of what's happening in the Middle East. So all of a sudden, you know, from a personal perspective, and I think it's very much a function of having spent, you know, time in the UK, I suddenly have a much wider perspective on what is happening.
In preparation for this interview, I did a little bit of research and watched back a number of interviews that you've done across both the global and local spectrum. And just on that global view, you did an interview in May 2023 with Leanne Mannes on SABC talking about the relevance of South Africa and the fact that we had lost relevance on the global stage. With your vista now, where do we stand as South Africa? And of course, that also brings me to the political landscape. So I'm going to turn it over to you here.
So I think, you know, again, global stage, we have become irrelevant in terms of global discussion on where to invest, and is South Africa an investable terrain? Now, back 2023, we have to go back to load shedding, and although that seemed to have been, you know, under control, effectively that has affected global sentiment towards South Africa. So as an emerging market, we really were off the take in discussions. Again, in beginning of this year, I was in Miami, again, speaking at a Saudi Arabia organized conference. There were a lot of investment managers there. And just to give you a footnote, which really kind of, I think, sums it up, there was a panel of some of the best and largest CEOs and CIOs of asset management companies in the US. And one of the participants started talking about BRICS and the fact that US cannot ignore the BRICS from an investment perspective. And there was a little bit of a discussion around it. And then he started listing the BRICS as being, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And then he stopped. And then he went again about the BRICS. And suddenly I realized that he literally thought the S in BRICS is a plural in BRICS and not a country. And when it came to me speaking, that was my opening line, which was, I just wanted to point out that the S in the BRICS is South Africa. It's a country. And that, if that doesn't sum up everything you need to know about, is South Africa a topic of discussion in terms of investments? There you go. We are plural letter.
You also made a statement where you said, we don't punch above our weight, we just punch ourselves. And that brings me now to the political spectrum. Are you feeling more positive given the government of national unity? I love your insights on the political side, so don't hold back.
So I think, you know, that the issue is, it's one thing to talk about the fact that we are politically neutral and we stay neutral in terms of global politics. But of course, that is not how it's perceived, and that is not what we're doing. We are clearly, in the eyes of international investors, aligning ourselves with the BRICS. We are not criticizing Russia. We have aligned ourselves, rightly or wrongly, so I'm not commenting on that. But of course, in terms of Palestine and the Gaza Strip, that is where we are aligned. So it's one thing to talk about neutrality. That is not how we are perceived. And that, of course, affects, and it's, you know, naive to suppose it doesn't. It affects the perceptions of international investors into South Africa. And I'm aware of, I mean, without listing them, I'm aware of some large financial institutions in the US who have decided not to invest in South Africa based on, you know, a political stance. So it's all, again, very well to talk about neutrality. You know, we talk a lot about US and our dependence on US, and that's also an interesting factor for me, because we've got this GOAN Act, which, you know, US kind of holds over South Africa as an issue. And in fact, South Africa's utilization of GOA is very small, and arguably US depends on South Africa a lot more than South Africa depends on the US. However, if we want to grow, you know, exports, imports are key to that growth. Foreign investment is key to that growth. So do we want to take political stances which alienate, whether we say we're neutral or not, that alienate large foreign investors? And arguably, you know, I clearly would say we can't. It's an emerging economy with load shedding, with unemployment, with a low growth rate. Do what we are doing. Now, with the government of national unity, I'm hoping for one thing, and that is that, you know, to date, the ANC and the majority rule, we had a situation where we had a mingling of party philosophies and views versus South African views. So the two were indistinct. The views that ANC held and alliances that ANC might have had for historical reasons were immediately interpreted as the views of South Africa. With the government of national unity, I think that there will be a divergence between ANC ideology and what South Africa as a country stands for. And that is what makes me a lot more optimistic than I was before.
Magda, were you, as you said, you're more optimistic about the political landscape, given what has transpired over the election and the government of national unity? Were you expecting this positive outcome? There were a number of investment managers out there that had positioned themselves one way or the other for the election outcome.
Ronan, of course not. And I don't think anyone in South Africa was. You know, this emergence of MK party, you know, I only have one question. And that is, who funded the MK party? Because I do not believe that their emergence has come just because they were able to mobilize ANC infrastructure. Of course they were. With whose funding? That is my key question. The other issue is, of course, no one was expecting ANC to come in as low as they have. Everyone was kind of expecting around 46%. Everyone was expecting some sort of coalition government, and everyone was praying for a coalition with DA. What was disappointing and not unexpected is the low showing, or the flat showing, of DA. Now, this is a party which arguably has delivered the most to South Africans and contributed the most to the economy and has shown how an efficient governing structure can actually result in growth and improvement of lives, etc. The problem DA has, and they have not helped themselves, is the perception that this is a white party. And I've got to be perfectly honest, I look at it just in terms of top leadership. And I personally go, this is a white party. Now, the biggest, you know, when, and I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, and, you know, I'm not going to apologize for what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. I'm going to say two things. The first one was when DA sent a delegation to negotiate with ANC, and that delegation was predominantly white. And what it reminded me of is 1990s, the Nets negotiating with ANC. And how do you have that? The tension, natural tension in the room. For goodness sake, DA has amazing people who are not white. And then I'm going to say something controversial because I think, you know, it's criticizing someone who has done a lot. And then someone I believe personally, my personal belief, should have stepped down. And that is Helen Ziller. Because at the end of the day, she runs DA. Whatever one says, my perception, again, I might be wrong, she runs DA. And until such time as she relaxes her grip on power, and until such time as she recognizes that the future of DA lies in transformation and future success of DA lies in visible transformation of that party to the whole of South Africa, we are going nowhere and they are not going anywhere in terms of voter support than around the lower 20%. So you've got one person. It's a terrible thing to say, given the corruption in ANC and giving incompetent and giving cadre deployment, all of that. I do believe that in terms of progress, she, in terms of DA certainly and the influence of DA and the most efficient, non-corrupt party, she is the one that is holding that party back. And I know it's controversial.
Your message coming through loud and clear. I'm going to move off the politics and into the investment game and go back to Signia. You spoke about a new strategy. And I want you to give me a little color in terms of what that entails. You co-founded Signia in 2006. You've built an enormous financial services organization that boxes clearly above the weight of many organizations in South Africa with now that global view. Give us a sense of where Signia is going at this stage in its journey.
And so, Bruno, I think the truer thing to say is that we are punching above our weight. So, you know, as an entrepreneurial company, there are two things. You know, we do have a lot of flexibility to implement various strategies very quickly. So, you know, we don't have 20 committees that need to approve things. We literally have an exco and we present it to the board and off we move ahead. The other one is, I truly believe, is the fact that we've been apolitical and haven't taken a political stance. And that has allowed us, or me personally, to voice controversial opinions. We are not beholden to anything. I don't have a single government contract. I don't have a single political party contract of any sort. And that is actually a podium that I have protected very strongly. I want to have that freedom. In terms of Signia itself, I think, you know, we've seen two trends. I mean, unsurprising to any financial services group in South Africa. And, you know, I've got to be a little bit sensitive in terms of being listed and, you know, disclosure of material information. But, you know, in terms of a strategy, there's a huge consolidation in the retirement fund industry. Most retirement funds are now falling into umbrella funds. We were very lucky to launch a small umbrella around six, seven years ago. And we are building on that strategy very strongly. So again, we are punching above our weight against, in pitching for retirement fund business, we are pitching against Sanlam, against Alexander Forbes, against Momentum, which are giants in this industry. And yet, you know, there isn't a pitch, a new business presentation that we are not invited. That's a very big focus in our strategy. We have repositioned it. We have come up with some very interesting features which should appeal to individuals in the room when we present. So that's a big strategy. And then, of course, the retail market and individual savers. So one of the interesting data points about Signia is that in terms of our LISP administration platform for individual investors, we have the largest number of individual investors without advisors advising them. And that is really, I think, appeal as a bit of a challenger brand, entrepreneurial brand, transparent brand, low-cost brand to the direct market. And we've managed to communicate that coming out of nowhere. If you actually think, you know, 2015, we didn't have a retail presence whatsoever. Men in the street did not know who Signia is. And we have managed to change that.
On that note, Signia is dominant in terms of exchange-traded funds. Talk to me about that philosophy, of course, because it goes to one of your biggest arguments, and that is look at the investment fees that you are paying.
Look at the investment fees. The exchange-traded funds, we currently compete, with Sanlam and Cetrix. So both of us dominate and control about 35% of the ETF market in South Africa. Again, slightly opportunistically, I never talk about, long-term visions. I always talk about a little bit of luck. We acquired DBX Trackers 2015. So that was a Deutsche Bank ETF tracking business. And that was 100% foreign ETFs. And I think that was, our most successful acquisition because it suddenly positioned us in the ETF market. Low cost, passive investing. I'm strong believer. I was looking at the performance of some of our index tracking funds, which have, and these are really Regulation 28 compliant funds targeting pension funds, a skeleton fund range in the unit trust space. So unit trusts are important because the performance you show is stripped of all fees. You cannot manipulate it. You can't add some random fee numbers onto it. This is it. This is what the investor is getting. If they see 100 rand invested, they have 100 rand. And in the unit trust space, with some of our products now having over a 10-year track record, we are right at the top of the performance tables. And that is a testament to the fact that index trackers over the long term outperform active asset management. And what we have seen in the last few years, finally, we are seeing that realization in the South African market. We are Johnny's come lately internationally. This has been around for, 20 years, this big move. We are seeing it now in South Africa, which is, clearly an incredibly pleasing thing to see. Well, if you are Signia, it's a very pleasing trend to see.
I want to take you back to 2021 to an investment conference where you made a controversial statement, and that was around ESG investing, where you said it's meaningless.
Meaningless.
Over to you.
I will repeat it. I think, ESG investing is a buzzword. And many of the large asset managers, in fact, even BlackRock, I think, have withdrawn from trying to market ESG. And I've always put it down to the fact that the G, governance, is there an asset manager in the world who says, I will invest in companies with poor governance? So we can no longer talk about the G because the G is standard investing by asset managers. So we left with the E and the S. We are past that. We have believed, and that's really the venture capital firm I set up in the UK, and that is to look at impact investing. And impact investing...
Bravos
Investment Advisors. So the idea of investing there is impact investing. And when I talk about impact investing, it's investing in companies which have a sporting chance of making a difference in, some of the biggest issues and problems facing the world. Food security is one of them. How do you address food security? Of course, renewable energy is another one. How do you deal with renewable energy? How do you deal with climate change? What are the innovations in the space of climate change?
So I think it's important because the environment you know, in disregarding that statement, many may jump in and say, what are your thoughts on the environment then? Are you saying that this isn't a real theme that we should be taking into cognizance when we look at our investment base? But you're saying you've got those focused funds, specifically climate, specifically renewable.
So we've got those type of funds, but we invest in not even startup companies. Companies, I mean, in this case, emerging out of Oxford University based on years of science, but companies which have come up with novel and completely different approaches to addressing these problems. So, you know, one of our most, and I'll use one example, but one of my most exciting companies is a company called WildBio. And they have developed a methodology for enhancing crop yield by 20 to 30%. So right there is a company that has the potential to deal with food security if the technology is more widely spread. Health tech, you know, we invest in a company which can diagnose any number of conditions in 15 minutes in an emergency room setting at a fraction of a cost that Pathcare currently charges us. You know, yet another company is a company which has climate change, which has managed to recycle aviation fuel. So, you know, aviation fuel, one of the most widely, you know, wide polluters, carbon dioxide emitters in the world. They have found a way, which, look, again, it's in testing phases, but a way of recycling aviation fuel. So those are the type of things that you want to look at if you want to make a difference, not using the buzzword of ESG investing, which everyone is using. You need to, if you want to make a difference, impact investing.
So impact investing, and I just want to clarify this point, given the depth of the examples that you have brought to bear in the discussion, you do care about climate change.
Enormously. Can you not care about climate change if you look at what is happening in Cape Town right now? You've got 15,000 displaced people in South Africa, one city, a five-day event. How can you say that this is randomness, that climate change doesn't exist? And of course, when you look at COP28, which has just happened, and the fact that Joe Biden did not bother to attend, that climate change in the context of oil has been softened in terms of people talking about renewables. How can you not care? We know that climate change is there. You really don't have to be a genius. And, you know, so how can we not care in utilizing the resources we have, and of course, financial resources, in investing into the future of our children? You know, we probably, as we stand here now, probably will not live through the technological innovation that's happening and the impact that it will have. But I look at my kids and I hope that, you know, in their universe, they will still want to have children and not say, Mom, I don't want to have children because look at the future of the planet.
I actually have considered having that conversation with my children already. But that's another conversation for another day. I want to come back to the healthcare component because I know that the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID vaccine foray or the fund was a big investment from your side. And you mentioned healthcare and you've also said you want to apply some of the Oxford learnings to universities within the South African space. In terms of looking at intellectual property, elaborate on that theme.
So, you know, just in terms of AstraZeneca vaccine, the development of that vaccine was premised on innovation that came out of Oxford. The IP behind it was owned by a company called Vasitech. The Oxford University instructions were that during the pandemic, AstraZeneca cannot make and Vasitech cannot make any money out of the vaccine that will be developed while the pandemic lasts. So there was absolutely no profit derived from that vaccine. It remained the lowest cost producer of vaccines in the world, and it was the most widely used vaccine around the world just because of the cost. So it wasn't Moderna and it wasn't Pfizer, which required cold storage. It actually was the AstraZeneca vaccine. From an investment perspective, of course, everyone threw the money at companies which were in the space of manufacturing vaccines. No one knew at that stage how long the pandemic would last, and everyone was panicking. What we have subsequently seen, and you know, look, you know, hindsight is perfect science. Of course, what we
took the words out of my mouth.
Exactly. So, you know, in that context, of course, that would have been a great investment if perversely COVID had lasted and we were still under the lockdown of crazy governments with too much power and world population who listened. But, you know, if that had continued, of course, these companies would have made a lot of money out of these vaccines. Pandemic stopped, vaccine development stopped, and we've seen the Pfizer share price collapse on the back of, you know, that big revenue spinner discontinuing.
Indication. So, oh, sorry, continue with that theme. I want you to finish the theme on the healthcare fund.
So, you know, in the terms of the healthcare fund, I think, you know, the biggest issue is to deliver healthcare widely and in the most affordable manner possible. And this is where, you know, Africa has been left far behind everybody else because, you know, healthcare is often regarded as a first world problem. And hence, all the innovation that we are really seeing talks to first world innovation. So when I wanted to set up a fund very similar to what we ran in the UK, which is a fund which absolutely focuses on all the spin-out companies based on research that have been premised on research done at Oxford University. I looked at South African universities. I've approached most of them. And of course, innovation is happening in South African universities, within South African universities, in broad range of fields. What those companies require is they require funding. And all of them, when I approached them, were super excited. They all have, you know, tech transfer offices. So super excited that someone was looking at them and saying, I want to support South African innovation. I then set up the fund. That's the, you know, ham in the sandwich. And then I moved to the other side. And the other side was raising money. And I approached some of the largest pension funds in South Africa. And the answer was universally, and I don't want some of, you know, talk about some funds because, you know, that would be too embarrassing or should be to those funds. But the answer was universally, no, no, we're not. We can commit maybe 20 million to you, to this fund. But we, you know, if we're talking about innovation, we are investing offshore. We are not interested in investing in South African innovation. And it was the most, you know, disappointing message, of course, embarrassing message to me personally, because I had to turn back to universities and say, I am unable to raise money for a fund of this nature. And, you know, if I'm not able to, and I mean, I'm not trying to talk myself up, but I've been in this industry for 30 years. I've raised lots of money for different type of products, and I have never encountered pension funds saying, we are not, you know, we're not willing to commit money to South African innovation. What does it mean? In practice, it means that some of our more brightest brains, best innovation, leave South Africa. They go to predominantly US, where funding is unlimited. And that IP, that growth, that job creation is now happening, premised on South African research, is happening in US, funded by US, belonging to US. Hugely disappointing.
Do you walk away now? Is there no further room to pursue the education funding?
Brandon, I don't know. I really tried. Trust me, I tried to the point at which I spent money on setting up the structures. I spent money on talking to people who are committed to join me in running these products. I had the universities lined up. How do I deal with lack of funding? And of course, what I could now do with my, and that takes us back right to the beginning of the discussion. I now, being in London, having exposure to a lot of other venture capital funds, international ones, of course, it's, you know, I don't want to say it easy, but it's relatively easy to make a phone call and say, guys, why don't we look at, as US-based venture capital funds or UK-based venture capital funds, why don't you look at South African innovation? Why don't you commit money to a fund, for that matter? Doesn't have to be a fee of 2%, so that I can fund South African innovation. Absolutely doable if we were not associated with Russia, Hamas, if we didn't have load shedding, if we weren't associated with the world corruption. Eminently something that I think is at least something that I would be more than willing to try. But we need to deal with some of the issues that South Africa is facing before we can look at, you know, never mind foreign investment or fixed investment in South Africa, but more risky investments such as supporting innovation in Africa for all intents and purposes. So I haven't given up, but I've paused.
Talking about innovation and new investment ideas, this is something obviously that you always look to specifically within the Bravos Investment Advisors fold. There's not a boardroom in the world right now that isn't talking about AI, generative AI, the impact. I want you to give me a sense on how you view that theme. And then also perhaps, and I know I've taken up a lot of your time, to some of the other ideas that you may have seen incubating in different parts of the world, and specifically a keen focus on the US, because you've also stated that previously, to look at the themes coming out of the US.
Absolutely, Bronwyn. We run some products, you know, which focus on exactly that. And I try to, as much as, you know, I'm able to comprehend, dig deeply into AI and machine learning, simply because, you know, I've got a son who graduated with master's in robotics at AI, and in fact has decided to now, as a follow-up, study law in order to protect humanity against AI. Having said that, you know, what I understand is that, you know, generative AI as we know it is just a version of very complex algorithms which, fueled by enough, you know, power, can produce and run large language models. But these are models which don't think. They don't have emotions. They can spew out rubbish. A lot of AI, and people, of course, talk about AI, and guess what? Everyone seems to have adopted AI in their businesses, which is utter rubbish. In most cases, it's robotics, it's automation, and yes, AI allows you to finesse that based on, you know, huge data samples, but this is not something that will take over the world. We are very far away from general AI, which is the type of AI that would think for itself. It's not going to be based on the, you know, foundations that generative AI is based on. It's not going to be algorithms. So I think AI is very useful in creating efficiencies. It's something that through you know, more finessing can, you know, I don't want to say replace, but certainly enhance certain jobs and eliminate others. So it can enhance white collar jobs, and, you know, everyone talks about law. You know, nothing replaces having, you know, kind of emotive discussions in a courtroom. A computer isn't going to do it for you, but it can supplement and give you, you know, the ability to interpret and find information more quickly. You know, at the blue collar level, AI, if that improves robotics, clearly we've got elimination of blue collar jobs. However, you know, the interesting thing on AI is that actually, in its current form, there is a hard stop to the development of AI, and that is chip technology. People talk about infrastructure. You know, right now we are at a level when NVIDIA's of this world can reduce a chip to almost the level of an atom. We can't go any further than that. So there are no technologies on the table, although there are a lot of companies in the startup space, and we see this at Oxford, trying to work on a different way of designing chips. But until that is found, there is hard stop on the efficiency of chips who drive AI. So, hugely excited in terms of what it can do. but fairly realistic in terms of its limits. And the hype around it, I think there's way too much hype for what it can actually achieve. And anyone that is telling you, any business that is telling you, we use AI, is talking rubbish.
Any other themes as a final question that haven't been hyped that we potentially should have our eye on, of course, without giving away your own intellectual property?
So look, from an investment perspective, and I have said it, I mean, it's a bit of a, you know, controversial one. I have said it to my team over and over again, that there are three themes that will drive investment and investment returns right now. And one of them is very shallow. Humongous market opportunity, though. So one is, of course, AI and hype around AI, and in particular, the large, you know, Magnificent Seven. You know, AI is capital intensive. You know, it still has a long way to go, despite, you know, what I have said. You know, really in that space, if it's listed, it's the Magnificent Seven. If it's unlisted, of course, you've got, you know, a lot more opportunities, but there's more risk. Okay, so that's one.
Worried about the all-time highs in the NVIDIAs, etc. If you're looking at that Magnificent Seven going forward?
Not that worried. I think NVIDIA still has, you know, NVIDIA has such market dominance that there is no one in the space that can challenge NVIDIA until there is a new chip technology on the table. But we are very far away from that.
ASML featured as a ASML, does that ring a bell? It's one of the stocks that quite a few investment managers talk to in that whole chip manufacturer space.
Not from my perspective. And again, I do deep dives. And again, you know, chip development technology relies on, and all this innovation relies on capital. And NVIDIA has plenty of it. And if there is a competitor, unless there is regulation around it, they'll be bought out by NVIDIA. So, no, I'm not that excited over any other investment opportunity right now, irrespective of the volatility of stocks.
This was the first theme. Number two.
That was my first theme. My second theme is any company right now, and really we're talking about listed space, although, you know, I've seen this innovation, unlisted space, and that's where, you know, I can get excited, but listed space. Any pharmaceutical company working on cancer drugs, anything. If there are, whether it's therapeutics, whether it is, you know, enhancement to chemo, or whether it's a pill, any pharmaceutical company that can deal with cancer in any shape, size, or form, unlimited market. Cancer is, at least diagnosis of cancer is increasing. So anything on the cancer front. And then let me go to the shallowest theme. But I've been right for the last year in terms of the stocks we invest in. And we're not stock pickers, though. But still, we do invest thematically. So we do have funds which invest in tech. We have funds which invest in healthcare. So this is really shallow, but humongous market. And that is obesity drugs. So Novo Nordisk, people have heard about Ozempic, their patents. Right. Unlimited market, unlimited, you know, huge black market in Ozempic. There are alternatives to Ozempic. Eli Lilly has developed a much more efficient drug, but people want the first brand to the market, which is Ozempic. So obesity and obesity. You know, Pfizer is chasing it like crazy. In fact, every pharmaceutical company is chasing obesity drugs like crazy. But there are a lot of patents around that Novo Nordisk has put in place in terms of semaglutides as a, you know, kind of method of developing these obesity drugs. And they are growing and growing and growing. The only constraint being manufacturing capacity. And that's a huge theme. Lots of money is being made and will be made.
Magda, as I said at the beginning of the conversation, this is the highlight of my week, and I'm going to reiterate that at the close of our discussion. Thank you for being so gracious with your time, and I'm sure that the BizNews community is going to really gain huge insights from the conversation that we've just had. Thank you so much, Magda Wierzyczka, who is the co-founder and CEO of Signia, and of course also one of the founders of Bravos Investment Advisors.
Thanks, Bradford. And thanks for chatting to everyone.